Sounds True presents Women Who Run With the Wolves, Myths and Stories of the Wild Woman Archetype, with senior Jungian analyst and one of the most beloved storytellers of our time, Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes.
Wolves and women have been tarred with the same brush. They're supposed to be cunning and treacherous and untrustworthy. But the aspect of the wolf that the wild woman relies on is the idea of freedom, the idea of being unspoiled and having rhythms that are uninterrupted by overdoses of the intellect. So, bone by bone and hair by hair, through night dreams, through events half understood and half remembered, the wild woman comes back. And she comes back through stories. You see, it's told that there's a place in the desert where the spirit of women and the spirit of wolves meet across time. The Spanish land-grant farmers and the Pueblo people of the Southwest tell stories about the bone people, the old ones who bring the dead back to life. They are said to restore both humans and animals. So here is the story of La Loba. There's an old woman who lives in a hidden place that everyone knows but few have ever seen. And as in the fairy tales of Eastern Europe, she seems to wait for lost or wandering people and seekers to come to her place. She is circumspect, often hairy, always fat, and especially wishes to evade most company. She's both a crower and a cackler, generally having more animal sounds than human ones, and they say that she lives among the rotten granite slopes in Tarahumara Indian Territory. And some say she is buried outside of Phoenix, near a well. She is said to have been seen traveling south on many an occasion to Monte Alban. Some say that she stands by the highway near El Paso, or that she has been sighted walking to market above Oaxaca, with strangely formed boughs of firewood upon her back. And she's called by many names. La Huesera, Bone Woman. La Tarapera, the Gatherer. And La Loba, the Wolf Woman. Now the sole work of La Loba is the collecting of bones. She is known to collect and preserve especially that which is in danger of being lost to the world, and her cave is filled with the bones of all manner of desert creatures. Deer, rattlesnakes, crow. But her specialty is said to be wolves. She creeps and crawls and sifts through the montañas and the arroyos, the dry riverbeds, looking for wolf bones. And when she has assembled an entire skeleton, when the last bone is in place, the last one, often the tail bone at the very end, or one of the paw bones. When this beautiful white sculpture of the creature is laid out before her, she sits by the fire and contemplates which song she will sing. And when she is certain, she stands over the criatura, over the creature, and she raises her arms over it and sings out. And that is when the rib bones and the leg bones of the wolf begin to flesh out and the creature becomes furred. And La Loba puts her arms again over the creature and sings some more. and more of the creature comes into being. Its tail curls upward, shaggy and strong, and La Loba sings more, and the wolf creature begins to breathe. And still, La Loba sings so deeply that the floor of the desert shakes, and as she sings, the wolf opens its eyes and leaps up and runs away down the canyon. And somewhere in its running, whether by the speed of its running, or by splashing its way into a river, or by way of a ray of sunlight or moonlight hitting it right in the side, the wolf is suddenly transformed into a laughing woman with long red and black and silver and yellow hair, who runs free toward the horizon. And so it is said that if you wander the desert, and it is near sundown, and if perhaps you are a little bit lost and certainly tired, that you are lucky, for La Loba may take a liking to you and show you something, something of the soul. The bones in this story are considered, in archetypal psychology, the indestructible force. The one thing we think might be indestructible is the human soul and spirit. You really cannot kill them. Oh, you may injure them, or you may bend them. You can shape them, you can maul them, but you really, really cannot kill them. So the bones in this story represent the indestructible aspect of ourselves. Because the bones are wolf bones, that which is wolf-like, that goes back to the animal self of woman, the self that is connected to freedom, the self that is unspoiled by the rigors and requirements of a quote-unquote civilized culture. Within us is the old one, la que sabe, the one who knows. She collects the bones. And within us, there is the soul. Within us is the potential to be fleshed out again as the creatures we are. And I love the end of this story, because we are not meant to walk around as animals, you know, with long claws and our hair hanging in our faces, or anything like that. We are human females. But the story shows that the animal is within the woman. And she just has a remnant of it in her ideas. In other words, hair represents ideas. Hair growing out of your head, to the ancients, represented ideas and thoughts that were higher than the base thoughts, say, of sexuality, for instance. So that the woman at the end of the story has all the different colors of hair means that she retains the ideas and the memory of her instinctual nature. The desert represents the place where we all start. We all start as a bundle of bones, lost somewhere in a desert, a shattered skeleton that lies under the sand. And we need to recover each and every part. As the story tells, you cannot put yourself together again until you have all the parts lined up. And that's why people do meditation. That's why people do psychotherapy, and that's why people do psychoanalysis, and that's why people analyze their dreams, and that's why they read tarot cards, and that's why people create with their hands and do their crafts and do their dance, and that people do all the things that they do. The reason is they are trying to gather all the skeletal parts together so that they can sing over them. Singing is an incredibly powerful idea. It is the voice of the spirit. Talking is the voice of the human. Singing is the voice of the spirit, soul, psyche. Old La Que Sabe, La Loba, the old woman, sings over the bones, and as she sings over them, they become fleshed out. And as we pour soul over the bones of what we used to be, it revivifies us. It brings everything back in our memories of what we were and what we can be today.
I like the story because it takes place in a desert, because so many of us start out in a desert. We feel disenfranchised, we feel alienated, we feel not connected, sometimes not even connected to our families of origin. A desert is a place where small things grow. The life in the desert is often small and brilliant, but it's not lush like a forest. It's very small. And many of us have lived lives like that, where there's a little cactus with a brilliant red flower on it, and then you go 500 miles and there's nothing. So many of us have learned to live like that because we were born into families that to us were like deserts. For whatever reason, we were born into families that were not able to sustain us and make us flourish with a wealth and an abundance of ideas and creativity and relationship and so forth. And I want to share with you my pet theory about that. It's called the mistaken zygote. If you are listening to this and you're a woman and you feel that you dance to a different drummer, then you are probably a mistaken zygote. The zygote fairy is the one that carries the fertilized ovums through the sky in a basket. And when you were being carried to your destination, you were probably jumping up and down in that basket, and you were just thrilled to be alive and could hardly wait to be implanted and to come to life, full life, and be born. Well, you were probably one of those people who got so excited about being implanted that you jumped and you jumped until you fell out of the basket and got implanted in a family that was not meant for you. Your family was probably another 2 or 3 miles on. And as a result, when you grew up, you always had this feeling you're somehow born into the wrong family. And that's the mistaken zygote theory. And that's a very important concept, because the wild woman energy comes most for those who seem to grow up with mothers and fathers who look at them and don't understand how this person got here, who this person is, and how to raise them. For the wild woman archetype, there's usually tremendous suffering involved in the human life, in the human woman who stands in front of this particular archetype. Often from the time they are babies, they are taken captive, domesticated, told that they're not right, they're wrongheaded and improper. It could be that because most baby children, until very recently, were born in drugged births. They were schedule-fed, toilet-trained too early. They were handled like animal offspring whose mothers had died or who had deserted. They were trained to remain contained, to never really spread their wings, and especially never to find those who were like themselves. That was considered very, very dangerous. The domestication of the wild continued. So young females are taught to not like spit and moistness, sweat, and other effluvia. And out of the many possibilities of what it means to be female, only 2 aspects were given weight. Tis the sweet mother who always takes care and shows concern for everything and everybody, and the know-nothing maiden who is always sweet, cute, and innocent. Which leaves out the whole instinctual and animal nature of a woman. Yet by the time most women who were raised as captive creatures, by the time they were teenagers, they were exposed to art cinema. They were exposed to Latin poets. They were exposed to things and ideas, and often lovers even, who asked them to please be a full person.
So the veils that were laid down to keep the girls separate from their animal nature, well, sometimes they were torn and certainly wavered. And although many girls were raised in an orthodox religion such as Roman Catholicism or Judaism or Fundamentalist Baptist, by the time they were teenagers, particularly in the 60s and 70s, their religious faith was damaged. The hold of the religious symbols on young women of that time was slipping away because the sensuality of those women, which is not only sexual but also creative, was calling to them more and more strongly all the time. And the thou shalt nots of their religion were as much a part of the cage that they had experienced as their familial injunctions were. So many, many women during that time, not just in America, but in Europe as well, threw over the old order, said, no, I won't be caged anymore. I want to be free. And they went out for the first time in their family line into the world. We're all infected with a yearning for a wild freedom. But we all feel a certain shame in it. I think Jung said that one of the problems about the process of individuation was that in order to retrieve the gifts buried in the deep unconscious, one had to also deal with the instinctual aspects of appetite, creative life, sensuality, sexuality, love of God, that is almost mind-possessing. I said that this was the most difficult course to take, because there is, I think, in all women, a wild and an ancient gypsy that cries in anguish when we starch her flat. There is a part of us that can never, ever be happy until the gypsy can dance. There's a saying that after the world was created and God rested, on the eighth day, dancing was created, and that the world has been divided ever since. There's great truth in this. Something terribly mysterious, terribly dangerous, and terribly frightening about the aspect of the wild. Wild meaning natural. Wild meaning being connected to one's instincts, being connected to one's deepest soul. And for girl children particularly, as has been the custom for generation upon generation, the idea is to domesticate her away from her wildness so that she will be submissive, so that she will not cause trouble, so that she will not, God forbid, become pregnant, so that she will not bring shame upon the family for having lust. Except the thing that we've overlooked for so long is that lust is actually sublimated most of the time, particularly if your elders help you to sublimate that into something creative, so that a young girl or a young boy, for that matter, feels lust as a natural thing. Jung perhaps looked on it as something like prima materia, which means a basic, fundamental set of, say, building blocks that you can do anything with. Yes, certainly you can go have sex, but you can also do other things with it. The word sublimation is really a sort of an unfortunate concept, because it sounds like you take a drive, a sexual drive, say, for instance, a lust for life, and that you turn it into something less, that you
turn it into taking a cold shower, or you turn it into taking a walk, or you turn it into sitting down and writing some poetry, and that somehow that's less. No, I don't think that the aspect of the wild should be sublimated, but rather channeled. People who have an unfortunate predilection or addiction, that is, when they feel aroused, they feel only sexual. They do not also feel inventive, creative. And I always feel when I see people like that, that they've not been parented, that they've not been taught that that is like a river of water that flows always. No matter how young, no matter how old you are, it flows always, and that you can use it for sexuality, sexual activity, but you can also use it for many, many, many other things. Use it to grow flowers with. You can use it to make a desert into a green land. You can use it to cook with. You can use it for many, many, many things. And the woman who's in touch with her immediate wild instincts knows that for a fact. There's a great problem in the 60s and 70s as well with women who suddenly were released from their cages and didn't know what to do with themselves. What was before them was all the booze they wanted, all the drugs they wanted, all the lovers that they wanted. Everything that they had been starving for all those years was suddenly before them. And unfortunately and tragically, many, many women, accidentally or on purpose, gave their lives over those excesses. You see, in the world of nature, there are no ravening animals. The animal that is often compared to the feminine force, well, there are two, really. One is the bear, and the other is the wolf. And both have a very bad reputation, in part because I think some of Grimm's fairy tales, which have been reshaped by the Grimm brothers before they were printed, give a rather one-sided look at these creatures. But the bear and the wolf are actually incredibly social creatures who work by rules. And the whole clan, or the whole pack, agrees on these particular rules. So that wolves, healthy wolves, will only kill what they have to kill to eat, to survive. And the only time that they'll do what's called surplus killing is when they have been through a famine, which would normally occur during the winter months. And during those times, it's as though something inside them says, I need to eat and I need to survive. And I do this normally by taking down animals that are some of the time smaller than I, some of the times bigger than I. And once springtime comes and the snows melt and they have access to game, they'll kill everything in sight and go on a killing frenzy. And they won't eat the meat. And they won't cache the meat. They will leave it. This is very similar to what can happen to a woman who has been a captured woman, an over-domesticated woman, who suddenly is free to do, be, and act whichever she wants. She goes on a rampage. So if she wasn't permitted to paint, she'd stay up day and night to paint, maybe for weeks and weeks and weeks, impairing her health and God knows what else. If she was supposed to be a lady and sit with her knees together and never swear and never drink alcohol, and suddenly she can't have enough of alcohol and she sits with her legs apart and swears like a trooper. This might be a period that any woman has to go through once she has been released from her captivity. However, there are boundaries that need to be put into place so the woman doesn't harm herself or anyone else. And those boundaries are the ones generally of common sense, like not drinking and driving at the same time and being very careful about transmittable diseases, being very careful about who you choose to be friends with, being careful about your health and your life and your love. Otherwise, you have just the opposite of what you had before, but it's just as destructive. In other words, you're captured before and you were caged and you weren't allowed to do anything. And now you're painting your life with very broad brush strokes, and the paint you're using is incredibly destructive. So if you are on the verge of breaking out of some of the injunctions that you have carried like a heavy, heavy weight all your life with regards to how you are supposed to act, and often that means acting exactly like your family value system. If you are on the verge of breaking away, taking a risk, daring not to act in the prescribed manner, in the manner that's approved of by all the people around you, then first, make some guidelines and some boundaries for yourself. And let them be as caring and as healthy as you would lay them down for someone younger than you that you loved. This is what the connection with the wild is. It is something that outlives age. It's something that cannot be altered by time. In fact, it grows more rich as a woman becomes older. There's a story of Bluebeard, which is a grim fairy tale about a woman who thought that she was going to be married to a very elegant and very wonderful man. And he tells her, somewhat as a test, that he has to go away for a while and she can bring her family to the castle and they can do anything they like. They can have tea, they can eat whatever game the cook prepares in the kitchen, they can go on rides in the forest, they can do whatever they like, they can have a really good time. And he leaves her the keys to the castle and he says to her, you may open any and every door to the storerooms, to the money room, anywhere in the whole castle, but this little tiny key right here, the one with little scroll work on the top, this little key, do not use it. And the woman said, well, all right, well, that sounds fine, and I hope you be safe and come back soon. And so he went off. Now, her sisters came to the castle to visit her, and they were like women are. They're very curious about what the master had said was to be done while he was away from the house. And their sister said, well, he said that we can do anything we want, and we can go into any room we want, but there's this one room that we can't go into. But I don't know which one it is. I just have a key here, but I have no idea which door it fits. And the sisters decided to make a game out of it to find out which door this key would fit. So they started in the top level of the castle, which was 3 stories high, and they tried every door up and down the hallways, of which there were 100 doors on each wing, and finally came down to the basement, to the lowest level of the castle. And they're almost to the very last door. And they're saying, well, maybe this key really doesn't belong to anything at all. But there was one more door, and they said, well, let's try this one. So they put the key in the door, and they turned the key, and the lock screeched, and the door slowly opened. I couldn't see, it was so dark. The sister who was standing in the hall said, well, I have a candle. Let us light it and hold it into the room. And that's what they did. And what they saw was absolutely appalling. They saw skeleton after skeleton stacked upon each other. They saw heads stacked together like apples in a pyramid pile. They saw leg bones that were sorted by size and by shape and piled up floor to ceiling in the corner. Oh, my God. They slammed the door shut and they took the key out of the lock. And the woman looked down at the key, and she saw that there was blood on the key. She went, oh, my goodness, I must scrub this blood off, otherwise he will know. And so she took it to the cook's kitchen, and she scoured it with brush. And then she picked up dirt from outside, and she scoured it with dirt, and the blood wouldn't come off. And she tried everything that she could think of, including taking it into the village and asking an old magicianess if she could possibly take the blood off this key, but no one could do it. So she took the key off the ring and she put it in her pocket. And when her husband at last came home, he said, well, How was it while I was away? And she said, oh, it was really nice. It was really wonderful. We had a very nice time. He said, and how are all the storerooms? And she said, oh, well, they're fine. He said, and how are all my money rooms? And she said, well, they're very fine, too. Then he said, well, I think you'd best give me my keys back then. And she said, well, all right. And she handed him the key ring. And he looked at the keys, and within a glance, he saw that a key was missing. And he said to her, where is the smallest key? What have you done with it? And she said, I don't remember. He said, don't lie to me. You tell me what you did with that key. And he grabbed her by the hair and he started dragging her down the hall and he dragged her down the stairs into the basement. And he looked at the door and the door opened magically for him without a key. And there were all the bones and all the skeletons of his previous dead wives. He was just getting ready to throw her in, to get rid of her once and for all, when her other sisters, who had also gotten their brothers, appeared out of nowhere with daggers and swords, and hacked and chopped, hit and slapped, beat Bluebeard down to the ground, and killed him at last. This is a story of a woman who is captured in a castle, which is also like a cage. She could do anything she wanted. This will remind you of women that you've known who are like wonderful, gifted songbirds who are pampered and seem to have anything and everything they want. They want to go to Greece, they go to Greece. They want to go to Cancun, they go to Cancun. They want to buy new clothes, they want to buy expensive things, they have expensive. They want to buy a new car, they have a new car. They're captured. Captured. And until they can open the room in the psyche that shows them how dead they are, how all the feminine nature, how all the feminine instinct has been killed off and died, I might say, in a place of beautiful death, of disgustingly aberrant prosperity. Until she can see that she's actually captured, until she sees that her life, her psychic life, is at stake, she can do nothing. And the key that has blood on it, represents her own blood and the blood of the female lines that have gone before her. There are hardly any of us who don't have a member of our family, a close member of our family, who we know was a wild woman who got squelched. I remember one of my clients, who was a very beautiful and intelligent and gifted woman, told me of her grandmother, who lived in the Midwest, and whose idea of a really good time was to get on the train and go to Chicago and wear a big hat and open her parasol and walk down Michigan Avenue and look in all the shop windows and be an elegant lady. And by hook or by crook and by fate, she married a farmer. And they moved out into the midst of what was to become the Dust Bowl. And she rotted away in that elegant little farmhouse that was just the right size and had all the right children and all the right husband. And when the Depression and the Dust Bowl came, she couldn't go to the big city anymore and wear her big hat. And so one day, after washing the wooden floor in the kitchen and the living room by hand and putting on her very best silk blouse and her very best long skirt and her very best big hat, she took her husband's shotgun and put it in her mouth and pulled the trigger. Women have a soul need to express themselves. Women have a soul need to develop and to blossom in ways that make sense to them. And for many women, the first capturing comes in their original family, in their birth family. And once they're adults, they have an opportunity, sometimes for the first time in their life, to be free and to redevelop and reconnect to the instinctual self. However, sometimes they marry too quickly In my generation, it was not at all unusual for women to marry when they were 18 years old, the day or the week or the month they graduated from high school. And as a result, they went from one cage to another, to the cage of the household of the husband. And unless the husband was a developed person, unless the husband was a conscious person, unless the husband had some seed within him that aspired to have his woman blossom, her ways of connecting to her instinctual self would aggravate him rather than make him feel rich in spirit. I can remember being yelled at because I was outdoors in the back putting wildflower wreaths together when there were dishes that needed to be done. Being squelched for loving beauty is probably the worst thing you can do to a woman. It is not possible for her to have a full life if that is done to her, at her, for her. There's a Russian story called Vasilisa. It's Russian, Romanian, Yugoslavian, Polish. It goes through all the Baltic countries as well. Vasilisa lives with a stepmother and two stepdaughters, and of course the stepmother and the stepdaughters really don't like her at all. In one way, because she's very lovely, very pretty, very innocent. But she's, you know, she's sort of a goody two-shoes too, you know, and tell her to go sweep the hearth, and she does it without complaining. And tell her to go sleep in the corner and not by the fire. And she does it, and she doesn't complain. Well, one day, stepmother and the stepdaughters conspire, and they decide they're going to get rid of her for once and for all, because they really just can't tolerate her. She's sort of stuck up on top of the whole thing without really meaning to be. And they say, let us conspire to make the fire go out, and then let us send Vasilisa into the forest to Baba Yaga, the witch, to get fire for our hearth. And when she gets to Baba Yaga, Baba Yaga will kill her and eat her. So that evening, when Vasilisa comes home from gathering wood, the whole house is dark. And she's very concerned. She says to her stepmother, what has happened? What will we do to cook with? What will we do to light the darkness? The stepmother says, you stupid child, obviously we have no fire. And I can't go out into the woods because I am old, and my stepdaughters can't go out into the woods because they are afraid. So you are the only one who can go out into the forest and find Baba Yaga and get a coal to start a fire with. And Vasilisa says, well, all right. Well, okay, I'll do that. And she goes out into the woods, and the woods get darker and darker, and sticks crack under her feet and scare her. And she reaches down into the pocket of her apron. And the pockets of the aprons are very long and very big. And inside the pocket is a doll, a little doll that her mother, her real mother, has given her. Her real mother has died, but this is what her mother left her. And Vasilisa pats the doll in her pocket and she says, oh, I feel so much better. I feel better. And at every fork in the road, she would reach down in her pocket and she would consult the doll. And she said, well, should I go to the left or should I go to the right? And she sensed that the doll would say yes or no, or left or right. And she followed what she felt was emanating from the doll. Now, Baba Yaga is a very fearsome creature. Baba Yaga travels in a cauldron, not a chariot, not a coach, not on a horse, but in a cauldron that flies all by itself. And she sweeps out her tracks of where she's been with a broom that she carries in the cauldron, and the cauldron goes flying through the sky with Baba Yaga's long nose that reaches the tip of her chin, and she has warts, and she has long, greasy, gray hair, and she has long, long, yellow, thick fingernails. Baba Yaga lives in a house that's even more peculiar. She lives in a house that is on chicken legs. And the house walks around. The chicken legs are huge. They're giant chicken legs. And the house walks about and sometimes twirls about. And the house is surrounded by a fence. And the fence is made out of the spinal columns of dead people. And on top of each picket of the fence that's made out of spinal columns is a skeleton's head. And out of the skeleton's head, out of its eyes and its nose cavity, its mouth, and its ear holes, comes light, so that Baba Yaga's house is surrounded by a circle of light that emanates out of hundreds of skulls of people that she has killed. Vasilisa sees a glow far away in the forest and realizes this must be the house of Baba Yaga, and she consults with her doll, and she says, "Is this so?" And somehow the doll seems to answer and say, "Yes, it is." And before she's gotten anywhere near close to the house, Baba Yaga descends in her cauldron and says, "What do you want?" And the girl said, I come for fire. My house is cold. My people will die. I need fire." Baba Yaga says, "Oh, you useless child, to let the fire go out. It's a terrible thing. What makes you think I should give you fire?" She consults her doll, and she says to Baba Yaga, "Because I ask." Baba Yaga says, "You're lucky. That was the right answer." And Vasilisa feels very lucky that she gave the right answer, but she doesn't know how she did that. Baba Yaga says, "Well, I can't possibly talk to you about giving you fire until tomorrow morning. In the meantime, I have a task for you. If you can perform this task, I'd be more than happy to give you fire." Vasilisa says, "What is the task?" Baba Yaga points over to the side yard where there's a great big mound of dirt. And she says, "In that pile of dirt over there, there are poppy seeds. There are thousands, there are millions of poppy seeds. And I want in the morning to have one pile of poppy seeds and one pile of dirt. I want them separated out from each other." And Vasilisa almost faints. She says, "Oh my God, how am I going to do that?" She reaches down in her pocket, touches the doll. The doll tells her, "Don't worry about it. We'll take care of it." Baba Yaga goes to sleep that night. And Vasilisa tries to start picking the poppy seed out of the dirt. She gets sleepier, sleepier, and sleepier. And when she awakens in the morning, she's so startled. She goes, "Oh my gosh, I fell asleep. Oh my gosh, I'm going to be killed. I didn't get the job done." And she looks, and there's a wonderful pile of poppy seeds. And there's a wonderful pile of dirt right next to it. Vasilisa says, "Oh my." Baba Yaga comes out of her house and says, "Well, lucky for you, you were able to do that. Well, I'll tell you what, here, you take this skull on a stick and take it home with you. There's your fire. Don't ask any questions. Just be on your way." Vasilisa starts to thank her, but the little doll in her pocket sort of jumps up and down a little bit. And Vasilisa realizes that she mustn't thank Baba Yaga. She just must take the fire and go. And so she goes through the woods, and she turns at every crook in the road that the doll tells her to. And night falls, and so she's coming through the forest with the head, the skull on a stick, with fire coming out of its eyes and its mouth and the nose cavity and its ear holes. And she gets closer and closer to her house, and closer and closer. And the stepmother and the two stepdaughters look out the window and they see this glow in the forest and they can't imagine what it is, because they have figured, you know, Vasilisa's been gone so long that she must be dead by now. And Vasilisa comes closer and closer to the house. And the mother and the stepdaughters are so horrified to see a disembodied skeleton with fire coming out of its ears and its eyes and its nose cavity and its mouth that they go into a faint. And when at last Vasilisa comes in the door, feeling triumphant and wonderful because she has survived this terrible adventure and she has brought fire, the skull leaps out of her hand, leaps onto the stepmother and the stepdaughters, and burns them into cinders. This is a story of the feminine spirit guided by intuition. I believe that intuition is probably the greatest gift that women have. It is like a divining instrument. It is like a crystal. It is like a magic wand. It is like a wise old woman that is with you always, that tells you exactly what the matter is. It tells you exactly whether to go left or right, has instincts that are right en puente, in other words, right on the head. The story of Vasilisa has to do with being one of those mistaken zygotes again. She is born into a family, or given to a family, that cannot understand her or appreciate her as far as they're concerned. They revile her, they hate her. There is a concept called xenophobia, and that means a fear of strangers. And almost all fairy tales and all mythology, many, many stories about the stranger, the odd one, the strange one, the unusual one. And often that person is the one who's real connected to their instincts, very connected to their deep, instinctual, animal, wild psyche. So they send her away because she's different. And they say, go and do this thing, and if you survive, ha ha ha, which you won't, then we may accept you. This is a very critical idea because a lot of women who are raised in families that are not accepting go on tremendous big quests. They have to go get 3 PhDs and they have to, you know, hang upside down from Mount Everest, and they have to do all sorts of dangerous and time-consuming and money-consuming things to try to prove to their family that they have worth. No, 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 that's not the way to do it. I think Vasilisa shows us very critically and very justly that the way to connect, to feel full and good, no matter what fearful things you have to confront in the psyche as well as in your individuation process, that the way to do that is not to rely on the family of origin, but to rely on your own intuition. You see, Vasilisa's doll is her intuition, and it's given her by an angel mother, by a mother that no longer exists. And you know, we all have angel mothers. Sometimes they are sort of living in the flesh. They are women who, I don't know, you take one look at them and you go, mama. You just know that they are mother to you. They are like fairy godmother to you. They are like mentors to you. They are like the mother that you never had. And these women are angel mothers. You're usually grown up by the time you meet them, or at least in your late adolescence. They're very critical to your development of your intuition, because usually their sole purpose in helping you and in caring about you and loving you is to reconnect you with the wild instincts. Here are some of the things that women can do to reconnect to the wild instinctual nature. I don't suggest that you do all of these, but that you think carefully about which ones would be ones that would work for you. Number one is to not conform to ideas without examining them first. So, for instance, if all of your friends are working for the Democratic Party for the next presidential election, and you want to be with your friends because it's a good social time, maybe instead you ought to think about what it is you really believe. And maybe you don't want to be with your friends, at least not in that context. Maybe you want to be sitting by the side of a beautiful stream with wonderful swamp irises all around you, eating bonbons and reading moving magazines. The way to begin connecting the wild is to ask yourself what it is you want. Now, this is a very important concept. It's the difference between things that beckon to us and things that come from our soul. And this is how it works. If you could imagine a smorgasbord table, it has many, many things on it. It has whipped cream and salmon, and it has bagels, and it has roast beef, and it has rice, and it has curry, and it has all many, many things for table after table after table. And you look at it, and you see certain things that appeal to you, and think, oh, I would really like to have a croissant, and oh, I would really like to have some honey butter with that. Mmm, boy, that looks good. That's an example of how you choose things in your life that beckon to you. In other words, you choose them by the fact that they just happen to be in front of your face at that time. If you want to connect to the instinctual self, to the soul of the feminine, which is natural and wild, then instead of doing that, you have to say to yourself, what am I hungry for? Without looking at anything, you have to go inside and say, what am I hungry for? What What do I want today? Oh, I think I want... You know what would be really good is some celery with peanut butter in it. Yeah, that's what I would... Is that on the smorgasbord table? Probably not. Probably not. So this is a metaphor for how to reconnect with the instinctual self. If there's an opportunity to buy a bicycle, for instance, or there's an opportunity to take a trip to Egypt and see the pyramids, you have to think, no, wait a minute, let's just forget that I have that opportunity. Let's go inside and say, what am I hungry for? Maybe I'm hungry for a motorcycle instead of a bicycle. Maybe I'm hungry for a trip to go see my grandma who's getting old instead of going to the pyramids in Egypt. And if the answer is the pyramids in Egypt, that's all right, too, as long as it's an answer that comes from the instinctual self, from the Vasilisa doll, in other words. That is really critical, and that is really important. Second thing that you can do to free yourself and reconnect is to not allow anyone to compress what I call your vivid energies. And that means your opinions, your thoughts, your ideals, your values, your morals. There is no right, wrong, good, bad in this world. There is effective and ineffective. There is sometimes things that are destructive versus engendering. But as you well know, a garden has to be turned in the fall in order to prepare it for the spring. It cannot bloom all the time. So that there are certain destructive things that are a part of our cycle, and they have to be allowed because they are part of our vivid energies. If we don't allow the vivid energies, or if we conform to people saying, oh, you can't say that, you can't think that, you can't do that, well, I won't like you anymore if you do that, or I'll punish you, or I'll leave you, or, well, you're certainly not one of my children if you do that. What happens is that those proclivities for expression go into the shadow. In other words, they go into the unconscious, where they fester and they mull around and they burble around until one day, under the right amount of pressure, they burst out the sidewall. And what you have then is perhaps you've been a good girl all your life and all of a sudden you tell your boss to go take a flying leap and walk out of the office and decide that you're going to join up with the Foreign Legion, which may not be real well thought out, but that's what happens when you compress the vivid energies. You always have to allow yourself innovation. This is what animals do. I mean, maybe they would like to, you know, dig their lair or their cave the same way every year, every time they do it. But the conditions that they find around them, they make adaptations to. So, for instance, if you decide that you want to have your law degree within 3 years, but it's absolutely impossible because you have to work full-time to support yourself and your children while you go to law school, then you have to make the adaptation to become innovative instead of martyred by it. See, if you're connected to the instinctual self, you always have at least three choices. You have the two opposites and then the middle ground. If you're not connected, you always think you only have one choice, and it's a yucky one, and you feel like you should suffer about it. Investing yourself in a close examination of your cultural values, your religious values, and your parental values can help to free you. Sometimes you can do this very easily by sitting down and writing, I must... XYZ. In other words, my mother says I must, my father says I must, my religion says I must, my culture says I must. And then doing the same exercise, only using the words, my religion says I must not, my culture says I must not, my parents say I must not. And then you can also do it by categories. You can say, all these folks say I must do XYZ in the area of sexual development. I must do XYZ in the area of interpersonal relationship. I must do XYZ in the area of career, recreation, spiritual growth, et cetera, et cetera. Then you get a very good idea of how you have been what we call introjected, which means that messages have been placed within you. It's like secret coded messages have been placed within sort of a piece of software. It's a little bit like a computer virus, in fact, that really interfere with the program operating the way that it's supposed to. Taking it from a mechanistic mode to a human mode, it means it interferes with a human coming from heart, soul, and psyche. And instead, they come from injunctions and introjects that might serve well in a militaristic society, but don't serve well in terms of the creative spirit. Don't be afraid of wet, moist, dirty things. Don't be afraid to get your hands dirty. Don't be afraid to have a dirty mind. Don't be afraid to have lascivious thoughts. Don't be afraid to have obscene thoughts. Don't be afraid of things that are future-oriented. And don't be afraid of spontaneity. Spontaneity doesn't mean being reckless. You know, there are these boundaries we were talking about before. It doesn't mean being reckless. It means allowing your heart to flower. You know, I don't know if you remember this, but in the 50s, there were these horror stories, and even in the 60s, and sometimes in the 70s, and I'm sure somewhere in this world it's true today, where women who are about to give birth, who are in the final stage of labor, their legs are held together because the doctor has not yet arrived. He's at his golf game or far away, or his car broke down or whatever it was, and the baby was not allowed to emerge until the doctor was there. That's unnatural. That's disgusting. Spontaneity means let be born what is born, whether all the right people are there or not. If you want to dye your hair red, you don't need anybody's permission to do that. If you want to dress like a gypsy, either on the inside intellectually or on the outside in your clothing, you don't need a midwife to be there to do that. You have a perfect, God-given birthright to blossom whenever you feel like it. Another thing that is really important to keep in mind is not to relate closely to people who douse their own passions, because they may very much try to douse yours, or they may try to have you act out all their passions, because they don't do that at all. We're talking about showing restraint but blossoming when you're ready. There are a lot of late bloomers among women, and women who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, sometimes even in their 70s, who have never put their hand to the thing that their heart and their soul says would be interesting, exciting, and fulfilling for them. It's never, ever too late to blossom. Late bloomers, as you know, when the cutting garden is gone in the summer and all the hollyhocks are gone and all the sunflowers are gone and all everything is gone. But maybe there are a few chrysanthemums and sometimes a few little pinks and carnations left in the early fall. Boy, those are the most precious flowers in a way, the most precious flowers of all. They're late bloomers, but they're a continuing form of beauty. I want to give total encouragement, regardless of what a woman's age is. Feeling what we feel generally is much better than feeling nothing. There are times when we have to feel nothing as a defense. We're so hurt, we're so oppressed, we're so scared, we're so confused that we just become numb for a time, for a short time. This should not go on for a long time. But generally speaking, the best thing is to feel. And if you feel sad, then cry. Or look sad. You know, don't be brave. It doesn't buy you a place in heaven. And try not to be invisible with your feelings. You have to share them with people. I mean, if people look at you and cross their eyes, look with disgust up at the ceiling, then obviously you're with those people who douse passions, and those are not the people that you should be with. A woman's lover is a very essential part of this connection, because a lover can encourage or destroy the connection. A lover needs to be, if I could use the metaphor of the gardener, they need to be like the gardener. I want to see you as the plant, and hopefully you see them in the same way too. And they will do whatever's necessary. They'll shore you up if you're too heady, you know, too full of blossoms and the stems are too fresh. They'll do what they need to do to see that you thrive. We don't want survival. Wild woman thrives. Survival is only the first step. Thriving is the top of the heap. It's the highest goal. And the lover, when the wild woman has an idea, the lover will never say, well, I don't know. Sounds kind of dumb to me. Lover will never say that. They'll say, well, I don't know if I understand. Tell me. Tell me how that's going to work. Having a lover that looks at You as a living, growing thing, just as much as the tree outside in your yard or the ficus tree within your house or the rose garden out in the side yard. Having a lover that looks at you as a true, living, breathing creature. Jung talked about creatura. It's the creature. It's human, but it's made of very fine and moist and magical things. The lover who supports the creatura in you is the lover that you're looking for. Where will we be most likely to find the wild woman? Well, definitely in the mistaken zygote. Those women have the advantage by the pain of their alienation and disenfranchisement from their families. They have the advantage of being closest to the instinctual nature through their pain. And if they can repair some of the wounds, which of course they can, then they can have a really solid conduit to that nature that is really quite far away for those who are willingly well-bred. Second place that we see wild woman is in the archetype of the witch, and maybe the ogress, and whatever awful things lurk in the psyche, things that one might dream about, women in long, ragged nightgowns eating things that you'd never find on a restaurant menu, things in the dreams, creatures in the dreams, creaturas in the dreams, that remind the woman dreamer of her elemental self. You know, maybe you're not a wild woman. Maybe you're not very identified with that idea. And maybe you're saying, oh, ick, yeah, who wants to be like her? And I'm telling you, you do. It is the way of retaining and developing your soul. Because the wild woman is the one who dares and who creates and who destroys. She is primitive and inventing soul that makes all creative acts and arts possible. So if you don't like the face or the image of the witch, well, wild woman has many faces in the archetypal world. You find her both outwardly and inwardly as the eccentric. Georgia O'Keeffe was a very good case in point. You also find her in the hoyden, the quote-unquote original, who defies custom and convention. Janis Joplin would be an example of that. We'll find her in intensity of any sort, most especially the sensual and the creative. She is often the broken-winged one who does everything all wrong until people realize she's been doing it pretty right all along. She's the poor girl who never dressed right, who had torn hose and they were all baggy around her ankles. She's the Raggedy Ann of the sophisticated world who pulls it out at the last minute, flies by the seat of her pants, cackling all the way home. She is the late bloomer, the late start, the autumn bush, the winter holly. She is Baubo, Hecate, all the classical Greek goddesses. She is the old girl who blushes and laughs and still dances. She's the truth teller. Maybe that people hate to hear, but they learn to listen to. She is not dumb, and in some ways not shrewd. She works on passion and the doll in her pocket, the intuition that leads her into and through all the world. She's an archetype. She's a spirit. She's an animatrix. That means a person who inspires or brings to life others as well as herself. You find her all throughout the Americas, throughout Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, throughout South America, throughout Africa, throughout New Zealand, in the circumpolar straits up north at the Arctic Circle. She is everywhere. She is everywhere that you go. One time when I lived in Mexico, there was a group of women called the Tijuanas, and they're down on the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. And these women were absolutely incredible. First of all, they were huge. They were 6 feet tall, at least, and probably weighed between 250 and 300 pounds apiece. And they were so infused with life. And what was most interesting to me, maybe of all, they always patted and hugged and touched each other. Not only their babies and not only their men, not only their grandmas and grandpas, but each other as well. A very touching culture. And you know as well as I do that touching people makes them blossom. is really, really an important aspect. If you watch wolves play together, they hit against each other's bodies. They hit against each other's body in a form of dancing, in a form of playing. It's that connection through the skin that also helps wild woman to establish herself as a force with other people. So for those of us who have spent probably more than enough time being an outcast, who were so sensitive that you ran bloody at the lightest scrape, you understand that in a sense you have to shelter yourself. Wild woman is like an endangered species who has to have a protective preserve made for her. The protective preserve is made by you, is made by your thoughts, your feelings, your mores, things that are truly pro-preservation. You have to become a psychic ecologist. You see, some wild women become seduced by excesses after so many years of starving. And they consider that maybe there's a reward of sorts, but it actually makes them lifeless, and sometimes literally so. So we are still in such a time where this is a struggle. This is not easy. Even though it's our birthright, we still have to struggle and fight to have it. And outcasts have a peculiar way of becoming beautiful. And outcasts have a peculiar way of becoming experts and talented performers and editors and leaders and even national treasures. I think that if you live long enough, the culture will find the truth of your eccentricity and embrace it. And I want us all to live long enough to see it happen and then some. And if along the way, as you are developing this deep soul instinctual self, someone says, well, who are you? I mean, who are you really? I'll tell you what I tell people. I tell them, well, that's still a borning. And all I know is that I'm really friendly, but not quite tame. So may it be for you.
This concludes part one of Women Who Run With the Wolves, Myths and Stories of the Wild Woman Archetype, with Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes. Our program continues with part two.